Once seen as a prominent and convenient way to travel in much of the country, railroad service has declined in recent decades as more people choose other travel methods, like a plane, instead of a train. But in Alaska, the railroad is healthy, thriving, and is the only railroad that still offers both freight and passenger service. We'll discuss the history and future plans as the Alaska Railroad celebrates its 100th anniversary today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
The seafood industry puts thousands of Alaskans to work across the state. From fishermen and scientists to mechanics and shipping agents, the seafood industry sustains Alaska's economy all year long. Alaskans take pride in the work ethic that drives the state in ways big and small. Seafood sustains Alaska. This message sponsored by Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. As a child, I rode Amtrak three times from Minneapolis to Nacelle, Washington with my grandmother to visit my uncle and cousins. It took just under 2 days, and it was a glorious adventure for a little kid. Now, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that I have not yet ridden the Alaska Railroad, but I plan to remedy that, hopefully soon. Trains hold a special place in my heart and in the hearts and minds of many people. I can hear the train whistle from my home in Anchorage, and I love that. Trains can provide a unique and relaxing travel experience. You see areas of wilderness and the backsides of communities that you would never see from a car window. They carry supplies to wilderness outposts, and they are often featured in books and action movies. The latest Arliss Cutter Alaska-based novel, Breakneck, from Eagle River writer Mark Cameron, has a gnarly fight scene on top of the Alaska train. 100 years of robust passenger and freight service, especially given Alaska's challenging terrain, is certainly worth celebrating. And today, we're happy to welcome the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad, Bill O'Leary, to the program. Also in the studio today is railroad historian Jim Blassengame. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lori.
Oh, yeah. You can also join us. Have you used the whistle stop service? Do you have a favorite train story? Do you think there should be more track and more train service here in Alaska? Give us a call statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Bill, I want to start with you. And before we get started with questions, in the interest of full disclosure, I want to note that Bill's wife is on the Alaska Public Media Board of Directors. But today we're talking about the railroad, not us. So, Bill, you're a lifelong Alaskan. You grew up in Fairbanks. Did you have experiences with the train growing up?
Yeah, Lori. So, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things, I don't know if it's the geography or topography in the Tanana Valley up in Fairbanks, but it seems like you can't escape the train whistle. You can hear it everywhere and at all times. So it really was kind of part of the fabric of growing up for me in Fairbanks. And I've got, you know, memories. I've got memories of being stopped at crossings and things of that nature, too. But there was just always, you know, the railroad around. And I think that's part of the unique character of the whole enterprise.
Absolutely. Why has it taken nearly 100 years to put an Alaskan at the helm of the Alaska Railroad?
You know, that's a fine question that I don't think I've got a great answer for at this particular point. I think it's one of those things that this, you know, certainly there have been a lot of different folks that have held the position I hold right now, and they've all done a very fine job. Many of them came to the organization with, you know, outside railroad experience, which I think was something as this railroad, you know, grew and matured and developed, was something that was definitely necessary. I'm sort of the first, as you said, first Alaskan to be fortunate enough to hold this position. But I'm also, I think, the first employee that kind of came up through, you know, from the railroad. I came into the railroad as in the finance department and spent a little bit of time over in operations before, as I like to refer to it, as ascending to the throne here almost 10 years ago. So I like to think that, you know, you bring an Alaskan perspective to this organization.
So on the way up to the throne, did you ever have the opportunity to actually sort of be in the cockpit or whatever it's called when you're in there with the engineers?
So the only thing, I will neither confirm nor deny that, but the only thing I will tell you is they did let me on the simulator once, and just suffice to say it did not go well for me. So perhaps my talents, if there are some out there, belong in more of an office setting, I think was the general consensus.
And Jim, your own history with the railroad goes back a very long time.
1968, yes. I came here in 1968 because I wanted to move to Alaska. And I was working for IBM in New York City. And when I had an opportunity, I looked for an avenue to get a job up, because all of the information that I got from the state is that if you don't have a lot of money or a guarantee of a job, don't come. So I got a job with the railroad because they had just acquired their first IBM 1440 mainframe computer. What I was doing for IBM in New York was writing software for the mainframe computers, and we were converting a lot of businesses up in New England from manual systems to automated systems. So it was perfect for me. And they said, how soon can you get here? You know, so...
What a win.
So I drove for 2 weeks.
And we'll hear more about that in a little bit. But let's hear from a couple of the local officials who were at the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Railroad that was held in Nenana last weekend and reported by KUAC. Here's Native Village of Nenana First Chief Carolyn Ketzler. She noted Nenana's long transportation history.
My ancestors called this land Nenana, a good place to camp between rivers. It did not take long for the site to become a hub for transportation, by cart, by plane, by boat, or by train.
And Fairbanks Representative Ashley Carrick described the economic benefits of the railroad.
The railroad and its builders, operators, and leaders have been one of the foundations of the state's development, supporting war efforts, transporting passengers between Alaska's largest cities, helping build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, investing in real estate, and facilitating tourism and commerce across miles of remote and wild landscapes.
I really like how she sort of just captured all of it in that succinct quote. So both of you, tell us more about the celebration in Nenana. Jim, you noted the other day that like 600 people showed up.
Yeah, I think there was, wasn't that right, Bill?
Actually, the latest count was a little over 850.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. So that was really good. It was a good crowd. And we had good weather. It wasn't raining.
Really?
Yeah.
So, it really was. I mean, if I can just jump in, Laurie. I mean,
please.
It really was a terrific event. I mean, we had an amazing outpouring of support from the entire Nenana community, from just really the interior, and really a number of people that also traveled. I spoke with a gentleman and his wife who traveled from Oregon up for this. We had a group of, what was it, Jim, 20?
Yeah, right.
You know, members of a group of Polish engineers, bridge engineers that traveled up there. But really... just an amazing outpouring of support for the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's fantastic to hear that so many folks showed up and from out of state. Yes.
So that Bill was talking about, the Polish group that came up, it was that firm that apparently had designed the Mears Bridge. The Mears Bridge was the longest span of bridges in the United States when they built it in 1921.
Wow.
So
right here in Alaska.
Yeah, right.
Land of big things.
And it is good today as the day it was built.
That's quite a testament, and especially in a state that has shaky ground as we have here in Alaska.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the Alaska Railroad's 100th anniversary. In the studio with me today is Bill O'Leary. Bill is the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad, and Jim Blassengame is an Alaska Railroad historian who is working on a book. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. 8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Do you have a favorite railroad story? Or are you a whistle stop user? We'd love to hear from some folks that use that service of the Alaska Railroad. Jim, the celebration in Nenana recognized, as we know, the 100 years, and was also where President Warren G. Harding drove in the golden stake for the completion of the line in July of 1923. That trip did not end well for him. It was his last. Talk about what happened to the president.
So the president and the party traveled to Alaska all the way from Washington, D.C. There was close to 150 in the party. They were advised by someone in the White House to wear woolen because it'd be cold. And so it was 90 degrees, yeah, and they were told to wear woolens, you know, and some people actually collapsed. And of course, the mosquitoes were out in droves, so it was not good. But the president then traveled back from Seward to Seattle to make a speech in Seattle. He had his wife with him. The ship had stopped in Cordova to pick up some crab, and the crab had been sitting on the dock for hours, and it was like in the 80s and 90 degrees, and we know what that weather is like in Alaska. So, and one of the issues is that the doctor that was on board had recommended to the president, do not eat the crab meat. And so he got a bit of a food poisoning, and he had a bad heart to begin with. And so the doctor had given him a purge, and he was not feeling well. So his wife, Florence, made his speech in Seattle, and they were there just briefly. And the next thing you know, they're on to San Francisco, and they got into the hotel, and he was not feeling better. And that was all heart-related. And, you know, so anyway, he passed away in this hotel room. So there was a gentleman who wrote a book on Florence Harding, and he came here in Alaska, I want to say probably 15 years ago, and he made all of the stops because on their way to the west, they designated Zion National Park also. Florence Harding was, and it's a wonderful book. It's on her. It's very thick. She was the man. She was the woman behind the man. I mean, she knew exactly how to make him president. Hmm. So,
but it was his last trip. That's
yes.
The one bit of a dark cloud there on the anniversary celebration,
right,
is that the president lost his life after that. Many Alaskans know of the, well, at least in South Central, know of the Nenana Ice Classic, an annual bet on when the ice will go out on the Tanana River. That started in 1917 and was also connected to the railroad. Is that correct?
Railroad employees did that. You know, they started just betting, you know, when the ice would go out. So they would put in bids and what have you, and they put that tripod out on the frozen river. You know, it's amazing to kind of see it, you know.
Yeah,
if you've
still going.
Not seen it, you know, when you know it's close, you know, you need to go up there and watch it. I did that a few years ago. So,
Bill, after college, you mentioned this briefly. You went to UAF. You worked as a railroad auditor. So what was that early work? What did that involve?
That's how I got to meet the great Blassengame, actually. Graduating from UAF, I became an auditor for the state legislature and was down in Juneau for a couple of years and then worked in the Anchorage office for a number of years. And one of the things at the time was the Division of Legislative Audit would go and audit different aspects of the railroad. And that was my first introduction to the Alaska Railroad, and first direct introduction to the Alaska Railroad and to the good Mr. Blassen game here. So did that for a number of years, and it seemed like every springtime there was a reason to be down at the railroad doing something, visiting Jim and some of the other staff down there. And so really, it was interesting because it really piqued my interest in just learning more about this organization, because it's such a unique organization, not only in, you know, from a railroad perspective, but it's also a very unique organization from an Alaskan perspective. Mm-hmm. And it really, as I said, piqued my interest, and was very fortunate then a number of years later to have the opportunity to join the organization.
Well, Bill, start us off here, and then Jim, you can please follow up. You mentioned the railroad's importance during World War II, that it can't be overstated. Talk about that. The military took over the railroad during that time. What did that mean?
Well, I think Jim would probably give you a better description, but I mean, I'll just kind of go quick flyover here. I mean, the World War II issue is just really just another data point, I think, that relates how Alaska's history and the railroad's history are just so incredibly intertwined. You can't really look at any major events that impacted Alaska, or many major events that impacted Alaska, without looking at the role of the Alaska Railroad in there. But I would defer to the good Mr. Blassengame for the details on World War II.
Sir, so historian?
So what happened is that they had moved all the families out of Alaska when the Japanese occupied the Aleutian Chain. And so and then they had drafted all the men for the Army. And there were just the indigenous people that were left. And so they were the... We had women, Native women, that were Gandhi dancers. You know, they're spiking the malls and what have you on the track and what have you. So what the military did, they came in and actually it was a U.S. Army battalion that operated the railroad. And it got run down during that period of time. And afterwards, then the Congress then appropriated, I forget how much, about $50 to $60 million to rehab it, because none of the maintenance had been done during that period of time.
Yeah. So, and the actual ownership history of the railroad is such a fascinating story in itself. It was the property of the federal government before it became a state corporation. Talk about that beginning and that transition.
Well, at the beginning, you know, it was not an entity until Warren Harding, the president, came to Alaska and designated, you know, driving the gold spike. Then it became, it was known as the government railroad up to that period of time. Then it was known as the Alaska Railroad. So if you look at the depot building downtown on First Avenue, and you look at the top of the building, it says the Alaska Railroad, and it's embedded into the concrete of the building. So during World War II, you know, they had blackened all of the windows in the building because they didn't want to show any lights. And I guess people with their automobiles had to black out the half of the headlights also, because they knew that the occupation of the Japanese were an issue. The other side was in Whittier. Nobody knew about the deep water port of Whittier, and they had the fuel storage right there that they used to pipe the fuel to up to the military bases. So, yeah, there were a lot of issues.
And the transfer, the railroad owns a tremendous amount of real estate. Talk a little bit about the acreage and then how it came to be that it went from federal ownership to state ownership.
Well, that's a very good question. The feds didn't want to, you know, they didn't talk about getting rid of the railroad until the 1950s. During the Eisenhower administration, what they did is that they brought up young executives from the Class One railroads to operate the railroad, and they were there for 2 years, and then they would go back. But the idea that the feds had is that if we could interest the Class One railroads in perhaps buying the railroad, then we'd be rid of it, you know. So they wanted to wash their hands. But it wasn't until the 1970s when there was a real interest. And then there was a GAO audit, the government accounting office, that came in and looked at the railroad and how it was being run, you know, because it still was an independent authority under the federal government. When Congress created the railroad in the March 14th Act, it was 2.5-3 pages long. That's all. And what they did is that everything that was what was there, they identified all of the lands, they took all of the lands, and all of those transferred to the state-owned railroad. But then the feds, which was after Nixon was president, he created the Department of Transportation. The railroad was lowered down into the bowels of that organization. Under federal ownership, it always had an individual that reported direct to Congress because it was a project of the U.S. Congress that created the railroad. And so it's one of those issues that we have dealt with for over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress, we had an assistant to the general manager that worked and lived in Washington, D.C., and there was one, Ed Fitch, who wrote a book about the Alaska Railroad, and he did it from a different perspective. But it's a very good analysis of railroad under federal ownership.
Let's take a moment to go to the phones, and then we'll pick up there again. Let's go to David, who is calling in from Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. I'm just calling, I guess, to tell you that one of the things that I found in 1916, Solidarity, which was a newspaper of the IWW, was a letter written by one of the workers on the railroad up here, telling about the conditions it was that they had to work under, that they would get like meat that was already spoiled by the time it got up. There was a lot of reaction to any forms of organizing, but they had finally organized and built the largest structure in Alaska at the time, which was their lodge, the Union Lodge.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you. Yeah. Interesting.
Interestingly thing, the lodge is today where the lodge was. Today is the ConocoPhillips building.
Oh, well, thank you for that bit of history. It's interesting to know some of that background as we discuss Alaska's 100th anniversary this month, and the train is still going strong. Let's talk a little bit about some of what it's helped build through the years. The railroad helped with the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. What does that look like today? There's no massive projects being built right now, but how does the railroad help support existing and ongoing resource development in the state?
Yeah. So it is interesting. I mean, there's no, you know, mega project going on at this particular moment, but it's still amazing how much the railroad does to support economic development throughout the state, or at least certainly in the South Central and interior areas, but really it does have statewide impact. So whether it's supporting on our passenger side, and I'm going to go a little bit, I'll get to the freight here in a moment, but just on the passenger side, certainly we provide significant lift for the visitor industry during the 4 or 5 months that when that's really at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we do provide year-round scheduled passenger service, and really that's for, yes, certainly for the visitor industry, but really it's more for Alaskans, and providing that service for Alaskans to allow them to access different areas in the state. In some cases, the only way they can access different parts of the state is through the Alaska Railroad. So that's something that I think is, just a really critical piece of infrastructure for Alaskans. On the freight side, we're three-legged stool. It's there's freight, there's passenger, and there's real estate are the real activities that we are the services that we provide out there. The freight side of the house, we're extremely busy at this particular point. And, you know, we move an amazing, you know, somewhere around, you know, 3.5 to 4 million tons of freight per year in recent years. And that freight ranges everything from, gravel, aggregate type products in, you know, short hauls from the Mat-Su Valley into Anchorage for road work and other construction, projects out at the airport, things like that. We also, through our very innovative service we have in conjunction with one of our partners, one of the Linden companies, we have a rail barge service, which actually does connect us to the lower 48 railroads. And there's, you know, effectively what that means is a company can order a load of pipe that's going to be needed up on the North Slope. That pipe can be produced down in Texas or in Florida, and it can be put on rail, say in Texas, and railed up to Seattle using one of our Class 1 railroad partners. And then it rolls right onto our barge. These are barges that have actually, you know, 8 tracks on them. So the cars just roll right on, sails up to Whittier, rolls off onto our system, taken up to Fairbanks on the Alaska Railroad, transloaded into truck, and then finishes up at its new home in Prudhoe Bay. And it's a tremendously efficient, cost-effective way of moving products. And that's really... Then you also get into just the amount of, a household and other type goods we move for between Anchorage and Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And there's a vast amount of activity on the freight side, all of which serves Alaskans, Alaskan companies, and does it in a very cost-effective, safe manner.
All right, we'll talk more about that, but let's go back to the phones for a moment. Brenda is in Deering. Hello. Brenda is probably still in Deering, but she's not on the phone. So... Let's talk a little bit about the tourism piece and how it has changed through the years. How has what you're offering changed, if it has, to tourists? And what are those services?
Well, as I said, we definitely support the visitor industry in a significant manner. And it's something, I think we've always had, I'll look over at Jim, our flagship service between Anchorage and Fairbanks, running each way. But we also, of course, run from Anchorage down to Seward on a daily basis during the summer months. And we also, starting in, the later or mid to later 90s we ended up in some arrangements with some of the cruise line companies. Some of them actually own their own rail cars that will then be on our system, pulled by our locomotives with our crews running those locomotives. Their onboard services, their people in the coaches are, employees of the cruise industry. And that's proven to be a very, very popular way of helping to transport their guests from the ships, either in Whittier or Seward or even Anchorage, to their destinations, oftentimes Denali Park, Fairbanks, Talkeetna, places like that along the rail line.
That's so interesting that they own the cars. So are they just paying a per mile fee or something to be part of the train service?
Oh, Lori, that's a secret. We never let that on. We don't do it for free.
That's right. I can't confirm nor
deny at this particular point. But it's it's a great service. They've got their coaches, and we provide the actual transportation, the pull, and it works very well.
And there's a deal. Jim?
So what I wanted to add, what Bill just told you is absolutely true. But in 1980, Congress passed the Staggers Act. The Staggers Act actually gave all of the railroads free will. Before that, when I first came to the railroad, it was all governed by the Commerce Commission. Mm. And you had to publish all your rates. If you want to ship a refrigerator from Anchorage to Fairbanks, here's the published rate. And one company against the other one could make a protest that you're gouging or you're giving everything away or what have you in order to get the business. So what Congress did, They threw out all of that, and they said, so if you have a shipper A that wants to ship 100 carloads a year, and you have a shipper that only wants to ship maybe 20 carloads, you can have a confidential contract with the one that ships the most. And you couldn't do that under the old rules.
Okay.
So, and that was the huge difference. But those contracts are a legal binder, and they're not public information.
I heard the word confidential.
Right.
Yes. All right. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the 100th anniversary of Alaska's Railroad today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you're interested in starting a childcare business, connect with threadalaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by THREAD.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the Alaska Railroad's 100th anniversary today with President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad, Bill O'Leary, and Alaska Railroad historian Jim Blassingame. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 907-550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. And I want to get to some of those emails here in just a moment. Let's talk about the passenger service. What is the difference between whistle stop and flag stop? Is there a difference?
So we are the last, last flag stop or operation in the U.S. to the best of our knowledge. And what that effectively means is you can flag that train down. I mean, effectively, it's especially used during our hurricane turn service, which goes during the summer months out of Talkeetna up to past the Hurricane Bridge a little bit, and again, really allowing Alaskans and others to access a very remote area that's off. You can't get there by highway. You can't reach properties. Some of these people have different vacation homes or actually live up there, and we are the primary way of doing it. And the way they are transported in and out is through the flag stop. We have a whistle stop service down on our southern end of the railroad, and it's a partnership with the U.S. Forest Service down at Spencer Glacier, which is a personal favorite of mine. It's really a great service where you can take our Glacier Discovery train to Spencer, get off, spend as short as 2 hours or as long as many days as you want, and then get picked up by one of our other trains on the return. And that's part of a service that Forest Service is slowly but surely working to improve. We're going to look at having up to 5 whistle stops down on the Kenai Peninsula between Anchorage and between Portage and Seward area. So it's really, it's just, again, it kind of underscores the unique nature of the Alaska Railroad. Don't try doing a flag stop with Amtrak.
Yeah, and you wouldn't want to be standing on the track when you're trying to flag it down. Right. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Susan is in Bethel. Hello, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I like the Alaska Railroad. Years ago, I rode it to go to college when I grew up in Palmer. And the last time I rode the train was the State Fair train, and that's a lot of fun. And that goes right into the fairgrounds. There's no place for it to turn around, so you kind of ride back to Anchorage backwards, but that's cool. That's fine. And the trains, the summertime Seward trains, the ski trips, the holiday time in the valley. Those one-day trips really give local Alaskans an opportunity to do the railroad without going too far away or being gone from home too long. And I just think it's so fun, the State Fair one. But that one seems to sell out lately. Sometimes I miss out on that one. And, you know, I got a funny story about years ago when my brother went to Fairbanks College and my dad dropped him off in Wasilla at the station. And I guess there was something forgotten in the car or something. And the train already took off, so my dad sped up to, I think it was Talkeetna or somewhere, the next train stop, and gave it to whoever, one of the staff, and waved at the train when it went by, and my brother looks out the window, and there's Dad waving at him at the next train stop. So I thought that was pretty funny.
That's a great story. I love the Alaska Railroad.
It's part of being, it's part of Alaska. It's part of what's unique for people that live here and people that travel this great state. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. What a fun story. And, you know, that cues up nicely several emails that we received from folks wondering about commuter rail service and expansion of that. You know, Susan mentioned the train to the State Fair. We have another caller on the line that has a question about that. And when I was looking for a house to buy a couple of decades ago, I really thought about buying in the valley, but I thought, oh, that commute. So, boy, I would have loved a train to ride in every day. Bill, help us out.
So commuter has been a subject for a long, long time.
Yes, it has.
And it's one of those things that, you know, to be very clear, as our chief operating officer likes to say, we like running trains. I mean, we think running trains, it's a good thing. That said, you got to take a look at sort of the big picture on commuter service throughout not only the U.S., but really the world. And there is not a commuter service that operates that is not heavily subsidized. So the vast majority of them, I mean, the best run ones, the ones that have the least subsidy, are subsidized about 50% of their operating costs.
Right.
We think the modeling we've done, because we've done a lot of work on this and looked at it, the modeling we've done would think we'd probably be closer to a 80 to 90% subsidy, at least starting off on that. And that's just due to traffic density and everything else out there. So it, as well as that, there are pretty significant capital costs out there to really make this an efficient service that people would use. And right now, that's, you know, so that subsidy would have to come from either most likely state government or some of the communities that would be the beneficiaries of this. And everybody likes the concept of commuter, but not to the point that there are funds available to be put towards it at this particular point.
So even though we have tens of thousands of cars coming in from the valley commuting daily for jobs in Anchorage, there's just not enough volume of travelers for it to pencil out. Is that right?
It's just trying to get the other part of it is it's not just the service from point A to point B.
Right.
Then you've got to, okay, now you arrive in Anchorage. And not everybody works at the railroad,
right,
although it seems like they do at some point, all right? So how are you going to get to the UMed district?
Yeah.
How are you going to get to Midtown? How are you going to get to South Anchorage if that's where you're working? It's, and even on the cold, ugly days, how are you going to get up to the Conoco Tower from there? There needs to be a whole discussion. The entire system would need to be looked at before we just put 300 people off in at 8 a.m. in a January morning.
Of course, yeah. And is it a similar consideration for train service from the airport? And I mean, there's a depot there, and there's not much else happening.
So the depot does get used significantly during the summer months, but agreed, it is not used for rail service during the winter months mostly. But it's the very same concept, really. It's just trying to put that service in place and getting folks okay.
Making it pencil out.
Making it all pencil out and making the logistics all work.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Georgia is in North Pole. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about, again, here kind of the same subject, expansion. I grew up in Alaska, and I can remember people talking about, oh, we need to get the railroad over to Nome or Bethel or someplace. And my opinion for this Kinross trucking from Northway was that why in the world, rather than putting all their money into trucks and drivers to continually be trucking it, why in the world are they not putting it into railroad track and moving that ore up via the railroad? Which then means that maybe we could connect to the Canadian railroad system, because me personally, I'd rather take a railroad train to Seattle than fly.
Well, thank you. So yeah.
Is there any thoughts at all of maybe expanding in that direction?
Thank you, Georgia. Interesting idea to get the trucks off the road. The Kinross project will put a tremendous amount of traffic on the highway in Fairbanks. And Georgia's asking an interesting question. What do you know about it? Was there any consideration of that?
So rail is one of those things that once you get it in, you're going to be happy you've got it in. But there are really pretty significant capital costs certainly involved in getting it in. And then there's also just the time that it takes, especially for larger projects, for the permitting and going through some of those processes. So we learned about that operation, I think, when the majority of the rest of the public learned about that operation. And it's something that, you know, and we were asked, okay, could we be a player in assisting something like that? And our answer was absolutely. However, you know, again, it's a significant capital investment to begin with. But more important than that, you know, if we started today, if the funding is identified, if everything goes well, we're probably looking at 5 years to be able to get through the permitting, get through the supply chain issues, and get basically the rail in, on the ground that would be allowed or permitted to, you know, help move that that product. All that said, I think there's been, you know, over the decades, you know, so much interest in a land-based connection to the lower 48. As I said, we're already connected to the lower 48 railroads through our barge service, but to have a land-based connection.
And there's been talk of this Canadian rail since 2019 or earlier.
Yeah. So there was a more most recent group that came to us, and we work with everybody that comes to us and wants to talk about that. They actually progressed, excuse me, this further than really anybody else had, but spent significant monies on engineering and design and you know, discussions about right-of-way and things of that nature. That one has taken a pretty hard pause at this particular point.
Why is that? Is it just prohibitively expensive to consider? Well,
I think from their specific situation, they ended up having some internal issues with some Canadian regulators about some different things. But, you know, just in general, it's, you know, pick a number. It's anywhere from a, you know, $15 to $25 billion exercise to look at doing something like that. Now, once you get that in, it's amazing, but that's an incredible capital cost to start
maintain.
With and then to have to maintain. Yeah. So it's
Jim?
So what Bill is saying is that there needs to be some sort of a resource along that path that the railroad can gain revenue from, and not just because you can't make it pay just on ticket sales, you know, for passengers going back and forth. So you have to subsidize it. Otherwise, if there were something that had to go to market on that path, you know, then you could pay for, you know, the maintenance. But you don't have that. I mean, so, which is the reason why you need to do your marketing study. So,
all right. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the railroad's history and the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud, drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Railroad today with Bill O'Leary, who is the president and CEO, and Jim Blassingame, who is an Alaska Railroad historian. He's also working on a book about the history of the railroad. A question by email from Sandy. Sandy writes, a few years ago, when the LNG option for heating in Fairbanks was under development, there was talk of the railroad transporting gas from South Central in special tanks. This sounded much more efficient and reliable and cost-effective than having a fleet of trucks continuously driving the Parks Highway. Is that option still under discussion?
Yes. All right, I can expand a little
bit
more.
That was efficient.
Expand a little bit more. Yeah, in the 2015-2016 timeframe, actually, the Alaska Railroad became the first railroad in the United States that was granted the authority by regulators to actually move LNG, liquefied natural gas, in ISO containers. So you actually load them into these tanks that are then placed on flat cars and moved. And we did a demonstration project in the 2016 timeframe, moved for about a month, moved a number of trains back and forth between Anchorage and Fairbanks just to prove that it could be done and done safely. And did that in front of a whole bunch of Federal Railroad Administration regulators. They were all extraordinarily nervous, but very pleased with the way it all turned out at that point. And since then, we've really been waiting for that market to mature to the point that that the utilities, are in my old hometown of Fairbanks, are ready for us because we can move that product extraordinarily safely and extraordinarily in a very cost-effective manner. So it's something that we are ready to go.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And thank you for the question, Sandy. Let's go back to the phones. Valerie is in Fairbanks. Hi.
Yes. Good morning, Valerie Deming. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Val.
I just wanted to share, and like a previous caller, I grew up in Palmer and drove to Wasilla to get on the train to go to college back in 71 and 72. And my parents did that because there were a few of us in college, and the train was only $40, and we got the return trip for free, and to fly, it was $80 each way. So we did save some money doing that. And so I know the train well. It does get a little boring close to where you're headed, but it is fun just seeing all the trees and going over the rivers and everything.
What a great memory. Thank you so much for the call, Valerie. Really appreciate it. Going back to some email questions here, there's another question from a caller wanting to know why there's no railroad connection to the Lower 48. And while we're on break, Jim, you brought up something interesting that folks should know about.
Well, it's written into state law that the railroad cannot be built beyond the Arctic Circle.
And why is that? What was the rationale behind that? Who knows? Lost to the sands of time?
Yes.
So it would take state legislative action to...
To change that. Yes, right. State. It's not federally mandated. It was state mandated.
There are some interesting and obscure details about the history of the railroad. One of the issues that we were talking about the other day, Jim, was... The railroad owns the bed of Ship Creek.
Yes.
And at one time, the railroad almost shut down fishing there, which sounds amazing.
We had a young general manager that was here from the East Coast and what have you. And while I was on the East Coast doing railroad business and what have you, I talked to him daily. And he says, you'll be interested to know I shut down the fishing at Ship Creek. I says, excuse me? Did you really say that? I said, Bob, do you know what's going to happen? I said, we're going to be on the front page of the newspaper for the next 6 months. That's motherhood and apple pie. You do not shut down fishing at Ship Creek.
A riot.
Yeah.
And that was the reason, because I guess fishermen were getting drunk and they were getting into fights and what have you. I said, call the police. Let them handle that, you know. But the railroad owns the creek bottom.
That is so interesting.
So they provide permission to the fish and game to provide for the authority for people to fish. So, yeah.
We're going to try one more time to see if we can get Brenda Endearing on the line. Hello, Brenda. Are you there? Brenda? Oh, well, all right. Jim, you also, in an earlier conversation that we were talking about, said that the original track beds were made with river rock. Talk about the problems with that and what it's being replaced with.
When the railroad was first built in the early 1900s, they used the round river rock, and that was an issue all the way through what we had of federal ownership. And more like in the 60s and 70s, as the tonnages that we were hauling over the railroad, rock that is round moves. You can't, it doesn't cohese with one another. What the railroad has done more recently and has done, and you, what did we do?
Curry.
Yeah, right. We have all of the rock, which is granite rock. The railroad owns 5,000 acres up at Cary, and it's some of the best granite that you want to see. So you're contracting with a individual that crushes it for you. When you crush granite, it has so much fracture to it, and when you set it down, it'll be just like steel.
Sure, just locked and then together.
And then you can put ties on it and then the rails on top of that. Prior to that, with the jointed rail, which is the other thing that Bill knows all about, you know, no more clickety-clack. It's called ribbon rail. And welding that rail together, because every time the train and the tonnages go over that joint, it presses down and you have a potential of a derailment. And we had a lot of that. We really did. Mm-hmm. So,
the Radio Free Palmer announced that the Alaska State Fair train would be coming back for 2024. Can you confirm that?
Well, it's kind of news to me at this particular point, but it's but that may actually be the case.
Bill, you're the president and CEO.
You know, the issue with the fare train is we like the fare train. We think it's a great service. I think that's something that we'd really like to be able to do. The issue we have with it is it's multifold, but really the biggest thing that's been facing us the last couple of years is having the staffing available to be able to run those trains during while we're still in our busiest time of the year out there. So that is tough. And having the equipment to be able to run those trains, do that. I know we're not doing it for 2023. I know we've been in discussions about 2024, and we hope that it's something we can do in 2024, because it's a great service. I've taken that a number of times, especially when our kids were younger, and it's just a great way to, you know, get off the highway, get out there. You can get in there and get that funnel cake before anybody else.
That's right, and a corn dog. Annie Feit, who is a longtime reporter and editor here, did a story for NPR about a decade or so ago about the Hurricane Turn whistle stop train. In the story, she noted that the conductor has to keep track of who gets off where and when they'll be coming back out of the wilderness. That seems like a tremendous responsibility. This story was in 2011, and at that time he was using a whiteboard. Is that still the practice?
Yes, they're still doing that. Yeah, they really are, you know, because some of the areas are a wilderness, and, you know, and you know, talking about the guns, you know, that I had mentioned to you.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people that live along that route, when they get off that train, that's grizzly country, and they have to have a gun to protect themselves. Ted Stevens called us back in the 90s and told us that Congress was going to outlaw any guns on trains. And he says, what does that do for the Alaska Railroad? And I said, oh, that's a big deal. So you have to take your guns and give it to the conductor, and it has to be unloaded, and they put it in the baggage. And then when they drop the individual off at the milepost that they're ever going to get off, then they handle their guns back to them. So, and that's the way it's happened. But you have to have a gun to get, you know, from the railroad track up to where you're living. It might be a mile, it might be 5 miles. You may run into a couple of grizzlies.
Yeah, you sure could.
Railroads are, modern railroads are tremendously advanced technologically, but in some cases, a whiteboard is what you need.
Right.
I guess so. It's so very quite efficient. True. Do you think in our final minute or so here, do you think we may see a renaissance for trains in the future, more travel by rail rather than everyone in a car? Not only here, but in other parts of the country. It just seems like a good way to move a lot of people.
Yes, I totally agree. When you look at the technology of other countries like Europe and Asia and what have you, and they've done all of this, that's because we in the United States have not put funding in for that. That's not a priority. And these other countries, they have so many people and the population that they have to do to be able to move people from point A to point B. They have to have good rail systems. They have to have good equipment. But they subsidize it also,
So
which is what Bill is talking about. The Alaska Railroad is an independent railroad.
Right.
It's responsible for all of its financial and legal obligations. The employees are not state employees. They're the corporation employees. The corporation is responsible for the retirement benefits, their health benefits, everything.
And so is there any state subsidy at all, or does the railroad corporation make all of its own money and do all of its own maintenance?
Yeah, there's no state subsidy to the Alaska Railroad. We do receive some federal monies just because of the fact we run year-round scheduled passenger service, just like any other scheduled passenger service provider receives. But no, we are charged with being self-sustaining, which means effectively we need to earn our own way through our freight, our passenger, and our real estate activities.
I have one more question in our final 20 seconds here. Ben writes, curious the status of the Point McKenzie rail project. Still just a rail bed, no tracks yet.
A mere matter of money at this particular point. It's actually a Matsu Borough project that the railroad is acting as the contractor on. And we are hopeful that we are working with the Matsu Borough to try to get grant monies to be able to complete that, because I think it'd be a great piece of infrastructure for this state.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a fun hour to talk about the Alaska Railroad's 100th anniversary with Bill O'Leary, who is the president and CEO of the Alaska Railroad, and Jim Blassingame, who is an Alaska Railroad historian. He's working on a book, and when that comes out, we can all read it. Right, Jim?
Bingo.
Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones today, Dev Hardiker and Maria Koop helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.